Now, 20 years ago this week, an IRA bomb attack killed two young people in the north of England. Three-year-old Jonathan Ball died when two bombs hidden in litter bins exploded on a sunny Saturday afternoon in Warrington. 12-year-old Tim Parry died five days later from his injuries. Tim's dad, Colin, became a prominent peace campaigner following his son's death. I've been speaking to Colin on the 20th anniversary of the atrocity and began by asking him about what sort of boy Tim was.
He was 12. He'd just gone to the high school. He was in his first term at high school, and he was very, very pleased to have made it to high school because his birthday was September the 1st, so he was the oldest kid in the junior school. He just missed that cut-off date. So by the time he left junior school, he felt like an old man. He couldn't wait to get to the high school. So he was absolutely delighted to be at high school. And by and large, he was a happy kid, as this photograph tends to suggest. He was a cheerful, sociable and gregarious kind of boy.
And he went out on the day you lost him, Colin, like any other day, presumably. It was
No, it wasn't. Funnily enough, he was on a mission. 6 weeks earlier, he'd had an emergency appendectomy. He'd been very ill. We hadn't known what was wrong with him. And by the time we realised he was ill, he was rushed to hospital, appendix whipped out, and was given a sports band by the medical staff at the hospital. When his mum went to get him, the hospital doctor said, "Now, look, no sports for at least 6 weeks." But Tim was able to twist his mum around his little finger, and he said, "Well, a few weeks on," he said, "how about I play in goal for the school team? Because goalkeepers only walk between two posts, a couple of feet, nip in the back of the net and get the ball out." And Wendy, not being sporty, said, "Oh, OK, it keeps you quiet." And the irony is, he saved the penalty. And because he saved the penalty, on that Saturday morning, that fateful morning, he went into town to buy a pair of, for your older listeners, Neville Southall football shorts, because he was the then Everton goalkeeper, convinced he was going to be a goalkeeper. You know, but for the penalty, etc., who knows what would have happened, but he wouldn't have been in town buying the shorts. But that was his big mission on that Saturday morning.
And went into town.
Yeah, went into town with a couple of friends. Obviously heard the first blast, because there were two bombs. The first blast, maybe 100 yards down the main shopping street in Warrington. People, I wasn't there, but I believe people ran away from the blast up the hill, back towards the shopping area, obviously moments later the second bomb detonated, and that was the one which did the damage to Tim and Jonathan and 50 odd other people. And the curious thing is that Tim's closest friend Pierce was standing behind Tim, and the bomb caused him temporary deafness for a few hours, otherwise unhurt. But Tim, in shielding Pierce, took the full blast to his face, and a piece of shrapnel, I presume, from the inner casing of the bomb flew at fast, high speed, and connected with his head. So all of his injuries were head and face. So he suffered horrific injuries, though we don't know the detail, and didn't ever want to.
Where were you at the time of the bomb?
We were just coming back from Wendy's folks' house in Manchester. Wendy had her dad's former car. The car was a bit quirky, and her dad had a mechanic who knew how to keep it running properly. So we'd taken it for a service, and then we came back to town, back home, I should say, and we knew nothing about the bombing until we arrived home, and neighbours were congregated in the street talking about it, and they told us, and then we set about accounting for where our three children were, and we accounted for Dominic, our oldest, and Abigail, our youngest, and then Wendy called the house of Tim's friend, and the friend's grandmother said that Pierce had been hurt in the bomb, but she didn't know anything about Tim. So at that moment, of course, we were very worried.
Where is he?
Exactly.
Is he okay?
Exactly. So we then set off for the hospital, and along with many other people, tried to get to the front desk to ask questions of the hospital staff.
And you were told in the hospital that no one fitting your son's description was there?
Correct, yes. When we said he was 12 years of age, they took a look down the list, and they must have maybe allocated ages based upon physical size to anybody who wasn't an adult. And Tim had shot up in the months leading up to... He was maybe his mum's height, maybe 5'6", which was kind of tallish for a 12-year-old. And I think on that basis, they thought he wasn't there. So Wendy then left the hospital thinking we may have passed him. he was going home as we were driving to the hospital. So she popped home. He wasn't there, of course. Then she came back. And it wasn't long after that that a Catholic priest, a young Catholic priest, asked us to describe what clothes Tim was wearing. And Wendy told him, and he said, would you join me in this private room? And at that point...
What a horrible moment.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, we knew we were not going to hear good news, but we never imagined it would be as terrifying as it was.
You went into the room, and what did the priest say to you?
The surgeon. Well, the priest didn't come in, actually. He left us in the room on our own, and after a few moments, the surgeon, who had been operating on Tim, came in. And he had an envelope, and he said, can you identify these belongings? And it was a St. Christopher chain and a watch with a canvas strap, which we could see was stained, blood stains, I presume. And he asked us, did we recognise them? And we said we did. And then he said the words that, well, are etched into my mind. He said, I'm awfully sorry. He said, I've been operating on your son for the past 3 hours. And he said, I don't think he's going to survive the night. And now, if you'll excuse me. And he departed as quickly as he'd come in. And we were left with this void, this total silence, this sense of, I didn't just hear that. You know, it can't be real.
How does a father's brain process that information when you hear that? I've been operating on your son. He's not going to survive.
Well, I wish I could answer that. I don't know. I don't think I did any processing that day or for many days to come. I think I just heard it, couldn't believe it, couldn't grasp the enormity of what I'd heard.
And did you want to be with him?
I don't know that that thought came to my mind instantly. I mean, I certainly was the next day, but we weren't actually given an invitation to see him that day. We assumed partly because, so far as we knew, he was still on the operating table. And given what the doctor had said, I suppose we had to expect the worst. But he did survive the night. And the next day we went to the hospital, and after the chaplain gave us coffee and biscuits and said, go when you're ready to go, I went off to see Tim and went to the ward. The curtains were drawn around the bed, and I must have stood outside the curtains for, it felt like minutes on end. It was probably no more than a minute, but I was literally terrified at opening the curtains and not knowing what I was going to see. But then I did, and Tim was on the bed. He was covered from the waist down with sheets, and the waist up he was uncovered. And his whole head, I mean, his whole head was bandaged, literally bandaged. No part of his face or head was exposed. And the stains on the bandage were quite blood colour. And there was a particularly strong smell, which I took to be Semtex. I don't know. I'm not an explosive expert, but... again, I looked at him, and I couldn't take in what I was seeing.
This was your son.
This is my son, though, a 12-year-old, cheerful, happy, laughing son, and he looks like he looked like the Invisible Man from years ago, the television series, when he used to be bandaged from head to foot, but his head was bandaged, and shrapnel, bits of tiny pieces of black shrapnel embedded in his chest, which were tiny bits of the casing from the bin.
And someone had done that deliberately.
Well, and yeah, they hadn't targeted Tim, obviously.
No, they hadn't. But they knew there was the possibility of someone like Tim and others.
Oh, yeah, it was a shopping street. It wasn't, exactly. It wasn't a military barracks or
this
a police
was an
station.
IRA bomb.
Yep.
And they chose to put it there, and they chose to take the chance that someone like your son would end up lying in that hospital bed as he did.
Yes, that's absolutely right. Yes, they knowingly, consciously constructed bombs, I should say, planted them in bins, timed them and departed, knowing what time they'd detonate and every possibility that shoppers would be seriously injured or killed of any age, indiscriminately.
I live in Northern Ireland 5 days a week, Monday to Friday. I come over here on a Friday afternoon, and just as I speak to you now, and I've spoken to the relatives of many victims on both sides, but every single time I do so, I'm minded to remember that when people talk in Northern Ireland about a new Northern Ireland, there are many people like you, and there's nothing new about your experience, because it's there and it'll always be with you.
Well, yeah, it defines us, I suppose, now, because we are known, my family are known for being the parents and the family of Tim Parry, who was killed in Warrington, and That's a badge of identity now, as far as we're concerned.
You had to make the decision, presumably you had very little choice, as to whether to switch the life support machine off. Is that correct?
We were advised that keeping the machine working and breathing for him was futile, because on the day before it was switched off, we were told the basic brain tests had proved beyond any doubt that he was brain dead. So were it not for the machine breathing for him, he would be dead. And therefore, we should say our farewells and get our family in and do our goodbyes. And that's what we had to do. We'd have been keeping him alive artificially if we'd said, no, we disagree. So that's what we did. And on the Thursday, we don't have a big family, but my other two kids, my father and Wendy's parents, and her brother and sister, so maybe 10 people in all, had their own personal time with him. But I stayed with him when he died. I was in the room. The nurses moved him across the bed, moved the bits and pieces that were strapped to him, and moved him over so I could lie next to him. And I lay with him, and I kissed him, and I talked to him, and I was there when the machine was switched off, and I watched him stop breathing and turn from pink to blue in moments. It was so fast. And it was so quiet and peaceful. It was almost like it wasn't a death. It was. I don't know, I can't describe it. There's my son. He's just stopped breathing. He is now gone. But there was utter silence, just me and him. And the technician, I think, in the corner who operated the machine. Gone.
And when you walk away, at what stage do you start thinking about the people who did this? Is there an anger?
No, truthfully, there wasn't. And that's not attempting to rewrite history. There was never any anger for me or my wife. I think
that incredible.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I remember meeting a wonderful Northern Irish man, Gordon Wilson, many years ago, who I admired tremendously. And he and I talked at length. And I like to think we became kind of friends before he lost his life. And I know he and his wife, who were super people, they didn't feel anger. And many people I think I've met who've been at the eye of the storm where they've lost somebody close, and particularly a child, they seemed the calmest. Maybe people on the fringes get the anger, I don't know. But we didn't feel anger. We just felt enormous loss, grief, devastation. And I don't think anger found any room to get in.
Ever?
No, thankfully, no. I mean, I'm pleased that is the case, because I don't think I could have managed my own sanity if I was mostly angry. I think I'd have gone off the rails.
You must have thought about the people who did this.
Yeah, we did. I mean, those thoughts weren't motivated by anger. Curiosity. I mean, I often used to say, I can't believe some guy got up that morning and calmly went about his business of bomb making, drove to Warrington from wherever he'd been, chose a bin, moved some litter, put it in, presumably covered it up again, set whatever the time was, calmly walked away and thought...
Watched other kids probably walk past that bomb walked away.
Yeah, I've done a good job, I've done my job. His job is killing and then going. And for all I know, he might be a father himself. He might have his own 12-year-old boy.
He would probably call himself a soldier.
He would, yeah. Yes, he would. And he would be able to detach his what he would see as his professional duty from his ordinary life. But that kind of compartmentalisation of your mind and your life, I don't get.
What type of soldier blows up a child?
What exactly? Exactly. I mean, he may not have thought it would have been children, child victims, it would have been adults, but nonetheless, they would have been innocent civilians. They were not military personnel or security forces. This was a shopping street in a town which had no significance strategically or militarily.
People, wherever they are in the UK, will have seen recently in the news rioting back on the streets of Northern Ireland. Do you think there's a potential for it to go back to the really bad days again, where people lose their lives? Now, the dissidents have killed some people.
Yeah. I think not. I mean, I can only give you my opinion. I can't say I'm certainly right, but I think not. I think the overwhelming number of Northern Irish people would accept that life is safer and better now, even if peace walls have grown, even if separate living arrangements have got more extreme now than they were back in 93. But nonetheless, the spectacular bombings and the regular shootings, that's in the past. I don't believe splinter groups will ever have the support of ordinary people to ratchet it up to the way it used to be. In my view, I think the killings, the tit-for-tat killings, you kill us, we'll kill you, prolonged the war and prevented a sensible and coherent peace.
But Sinn Féin would have supported that bomb.
Oh, I know. Yes, I know. Quite possibly. Yes, I accept that. But if you say to me the bombings and the shootings and the killings got them to the negotiating table and got them into government, I would say they may have got there a lot sooner had they gone down the entirely democratic and peaceful route. And I believe that. I don't just say it, I believe that.
Colin, do you begrudge them being government now?
No, if that's what people vote for, that's the way democracy works. And if Sinn Féin are the major party for the nationalist community, or indeed maybe not far off being the major party, that's the way it is. And, you know, I can deal with... I've worked with nationalists and Republicans. You know, I know quite a few. I know Martin McGuinness quite well.
Well, he's the Deputy First Minister in Northern Ireland now. Mm-hmm. Former commander of the IRA.
Well, you know, when we talk, it's extremely civil. It's extremely polite. And I don't find him a difficult man to talk to. In fact, I think he's probably made a major journey himself. And that can't have been easy for him. And I know he's been in some danger, perhaps, from splinter groups when he's made pronouncements in recent times.
Do you know if he knew about the bomb?
I've asked him. I've asked him, and he said he didn't. I've asked him, and I've asked Gerry Adams, and both said they didn't.
Do you believe them?
I'd like to believe them, but I don't know. I don't know one way or the other.
Martin McGuinness was one of the most senior people in the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
And he has looked you in the eye and told you he didn't know about that bomb.
Yes, he has.
And a major bomb in England.
Yes, he has. Yes, he has. I mean, it's always possible that the cell in Northern England, wherever they were, the communications got screwed up, they acted unilaterally. I don't know. But knowing Martin as well as I think I probably know him now, I'd give him the benefit of the doubt. I mean, maybe I'm easily duped. Maybe I'm naive, but I would prefer to think it's the former.
Why? What journey do you think he's come along?
Well, I think it's the same journey that many people in history have made, where they've been in technically illegal, illegitimate groups and fought against what they see as an oppressive power. You know, the history is full of people who were terrorists one day and are now statesmen the next, and no doubt it'll happen again in the future.
Where are you in your heart now?
Missing Tim. It's the 20th year. He'd be 32 now. Who knows what he would be doing? He might have kids of his own. I desperately wish he were here with us and we were a whole family again. That's where I am. But again, everything we do in Tim's name. The charity, the Peace Centre, they're both named after Tim. His face, like Jonathan's, is our logo. We don't have an acronym for a name. We have the Tim Parry Jonathan Ball Foundation for Peace. And we're parents. We're first and foremost parents. We're not politicians, we're not men of minimum and of God, but we're parents who want to keep our son's memory alive.
Thank you very, very much for talking to me. Thank you, sir.